This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Exodus. And now here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Exodus, chapters 21 through 24, with today's study.
Exodus chapter 21 is where we are tonight. You know, this past week I was browsing the internet when I ran across a humorous website. It's called the Citizen's Self-Arrest Form. The Citizen's Self-Arrest Form, and it came with the following instructions. If you witness a crime, it is your civic duty to report the crime. When a crime is committed, you have the right and responsibility to make a citizen's arrest. Thus, if you commit a crime, you should perform a citizen's self-arrest. You fill out the form, you check the box indicating the crime that you've committed and your motive behind the crime. Then you read yourself your rights. It's right there on the website. You mail this form to the nearest police headquarters, and then you stay in your house until the police arrive to arrest you. If you try to escape, you use reasonable force to restrain yourself. And if you do escape, you report it immediately to the police. There's even a button on the website you're supposed to click to confirm that you have successfully arrested yourself. It's a pretty silly piece of humor. And yet everyone who tried to live under the law of Moses was eventually forced to initiate a citizen's self-arrest. For rather than make a man righteous, the law only exposed our failures and our guilt and our sin. The law shows us what God's righteousness looks like. It also shows us how little we measure up. And then, profoundly so, it shows us how desperately we need a Savior. If we are honest to God, each one of us will be forced to initiate a citizen self-arrest. Tonight, we're going to look at the laws that God gave to the Hebrews. Chapter 21 begins, "Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, you shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing." Now remember, for the last 400 years, the Hebrews have been slaves in Egypt. Now they're free. And God says that their first concern should be the kind treatment of the slaves that are within their borders. This is how they can show how much they appreciate the freedom God has given them by how they treat the people that are in the same situation they were in. You know, it comes to a shock to most folks that slavery actually existed under God's kingdom, ancient Israel, in the Old Testament. But slavery was a real part of their daily life, and slavery was usually a way to escape extreme poverty. Slavery in ancient Israel was sort of an ancient version of bankruptcy. If you owed someone a lot of money, you could sell yourself to your creditor and, in essence, work off the debt. You wouldn't become homeless, and he would get his money. Or if you stole something from another person and you couldn't make restitution, you could labor for that victim until you had reimbursed them for their losses. It really wasn't a bad idea. The maximum stint that a Hebrew could serve as a slave was 6 years. And then in the seventh year, he would automatically regain his freedom. I think the fact that bankruptcy stays on your record, I think it's for 7 years, I think probably relates back to this ancient law. Verse 7 tells us, "If the slave comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself." That doesn't mean that the man will never be reunited with his family. It just means that he's going to have to purchase their release later. "But if the servant plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free,'" and oftentimes this would happen, I mean, the master would be so generous and so kind to the slaves that at the end of the 6 years of servitude, the slave would agree to stay in his master's house and serve him permanently. Hey, times were tough in that society. And oftentimes people realized that they could do a lot better as a slave in their master's house than they could ever do on their own. And so when that happened and someone wanted to be a slave voluntarily, We're told, then his master would bring him to the judges, and he shall also bring him to the door or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. The only time we've got ear piercing in the Bible, right here. The pierced ear was a sign that the man had become a love slave. A slave not out of obligation, but a slave voluntarily. A slave out of love and devotion to his master. You know, in the New Testament, Paul refers to himself as a bond slave or as a love slave of Jesus Christ. Paul discovered that he could do a lot better in the Lord's house than he ever could do out on his own. I hope you've made that realization. That, hey, he is a kind, he is a merciful, he is a benevolent master. And he is so good to his servants. Why would you ever want to be on your own? I'm content just to be a love slave of Jesus Christ. Verse 7 tells us, and if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. Now, a female was never really treated as a slave. If she were sold to a master's house, she came into the house as a prospective wife and, in essence, was betrothed to that particular master. Thus, if she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt deceitfully with her. Now, if she comes in, and if for some reason this master doesn't want to go through with the marriage, then he can't just sell her off to some stranger. Rather, he had to go back to the family and give the family an opportunity to redeem her or to buy her back. It says, and if he has betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. And if he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. Now, unlike today, if a woman fell out of favor with her husband, he wasn't allowed just to ditch her and marry someone else. He could take a second wife under this law, but it was his responsibility to provide for them both their food, their clothing, the marital rights. And if not, verse 11, then she shall go out free without paying money. Here's the big lesson we glean from these laws. Other ancient cultures viewed women as a piece of property. You could treat a wife however you pleased. She was totally at the man's mercy. But here, God commanded in his law healthy treatment for women, fair treatment. And in essence, he revolutionized male and female roles. God was the first champion of women's rights. In verses 12 and 13, God differentiates between first-degree murder and manslaughter, a legal distinction that we hold to even to this day. He says, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. First-degree murder always deserved capital punishment. However, if he did not lie in wait, in other words, if the murder was not premeditated, if it was unplanned, but God delivered him into his hand, and let's say the murder was a crime of passion or an accidental death, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. In other words, God differentiates between premeditated first-degree murder and manslaughter. And he assigns a lesser penalty for manslaughter. Verse 14, but if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from the altar that he may die. Now later in the law of Moses, we're going to discover that God assigns six cities of refuge where a person who was guilty of manslaughter could run and could find refuge, where the family of the person that he had harmed could not retaliate against him. But there was no protection for a person who premeditates this crime, for a person guilty of manslaughter. Even if they went to the altar, they would be taken and they would be punished. Verse 15, very important verse. And he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Hit a parent, and it'll be the last time you'll ever hit your parent. At my house, hit one of your parents, and death would be a merciful plight. Verse 16. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. Kidnapping, extortion were capital crimes. Verse 17 is another warning to teenagers. Hit your parents or hit them with words. Harm them with words. And he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. If you're a teenager, you need to be thankful you're not under the law of Moses. But learn from it. Learn from it. Learn what God views as important and respect your parents. God considers respect for parents a very serious issue, obviously. Now, if men contend with each other and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but is confined to his bed, if he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. In other words, the person who inflicts a serious injury on another person needs to cover his expenses, pay his hospital bills, provide him some back pay. Verse 20, and if a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. Now, a slave was considered the property of his owner, but there were limitations to that ownership. And if the owner was disciplining his servant, he couldn't get carried away and just beat him to death or kill him. No, he had rights over the slave, but there were boundaries, and they needed to be respected. Verse 22, if men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished accordingly as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. In other words, the expression no harm, no foul is not biblical. Just because the baby is born with no complications, it doesn't mean that the violent act didn't cause the mother some undue emotional distress, and therefore the husband was allowed to collect damages. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, womb for womb, stripe for stripe. Verses 23 through 25 provide the overarching rule when it comes to these punishment of violent acts. The punishment should always fit the crime. If you take out my eye, then your eye should be removed. Now, when we read this, we often read this as being harsh. Doesn't that sound violent? Doesn't that sound severe? Doesn't that sound mean and cruel? But this law was in reality a call for mercy and a call for restraint and for fairness. For if you punch me in the eye, my tendency is not to punch you in the eye. My tendency is to not only punch you in the eye, but it's also to kick you in the shins. My tendency is not eye for an eye. My tendency is one-upmanship. I'm going to get back at you harder than you got back at me. Eye for an eye was God's way of tempering our desire for excessive retaliation. It's a call for fairness. Verse 26, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. If an owner goes too far and physically assaults his slave, he proves that he can't handle the responsibility that goes with the employment of those servants, and thus the slave goes free. In other words, the slave receives something more valuable than an eye or a tooth. He receives his freedom. Now, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, I don't know if you've been worried about that this week, your ox goring somebody to death. Then the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. But if the ox tended to thrust with its horn in times past, if you've got a history with this ox, and it has been made known to his owner, and you knew about the violent tendencies of your ox, and he has not kept it confined, and you didn't put it in a pen, or wherever you put oxes, in boxes or something. so that it has killed a man or a woman, your ox gets loose and goes stray and kills another person, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall also be put to death. A negligent owner bears responsibility for his violent ox or for his pit bull or his German shepherd or his mad dog poodle or whatever it happens to be. Verse 30, if there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life whatever is imposed on it. Now, the ox's owner can commute the death sentence by paying damages for the harm the animal caused. Whether it has gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment, it shall be done to him. If the ox gores a male or female servant, he shall give to that master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And notice there, the price for a slave was 30 shekels of silver. And what's interesting about that is the amount that Judas chose to receive in order to betray Jesus Christ. Matthew 26, verse 15 tells us that Judas sold his Lord for 30 pieces of silver, the price of a slave. He had very little regard for Jesus' life, didn't he? And if a man opens a pit, or if a man digs a pit, I guess it could be a barbecue pit, and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls in it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money to their owner, but the dead animal shall be his. In other words, the disposal is his problem. And if one man's ox hurts another's so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox they shall also divide. Or if it was known that the ox tended to thrust in time past, and its owner has not kept it confined, you knew this ox could do such a thing, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall be his own. Now you read about one man's ox goring another man's ox, and you're wondering tonight, what in the world does this have to do with me? But these laws are extremely applicable to us. They teach us that we are responsible for our property. Whether it's an ox or a pit bull or an open pit or a sports car or the family car that you allow your kid to drive, people are held accountable not only for the harm they cause, but for the injury that's caused by the possessions and the people that are under their authority. See, the intent behind this law is still extremely applicable. Chapter 22. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. In other words, the thief doesn't just pay for what he stole, he pays damages for the trouble that he caused the victim. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. In other words, if a stranger breaks into my house to steal from me, it's my right to protect myself and my family and my possessions. And under God's law, if I pull out my shotgun and blow him to bits, don't worry, I'll witness to him until the paramedics get there. But if I do that, I have the right to defend myself. But notice in verse 3, if someone breaks into my house one night, rips me off, I discover it the next morning, I can't just track the guy down and shoot him after the fact. We're told if the sun has risen on him, no, the threat's passed, you're not, he stole something from you, but you know, your family's not in danger, then you can't just track him down. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He shall make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Once the immediate danger to my family has passed, then I can't just run out and kill him for thievery. Notice, too, the emphasis on restitution. If the thief couldn't pay for the damage he caused, he was sold as a slave, and he was made to work off the amount that he owed. We're told, if the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether it is an ox or a donkey or sheep, he shall restore double. And again, notice nothing is said about prison. Isn't that interesting? Today, somebody steals something from somebody, we throw them into prison. The victim probably never gets paid back. There's no restitution. This says nothing about prison. The emphasis in God's law is on restitution, on repairing of damage. The thief has to pay a punitive damage in the amount double to the person that he's harmed. Today, our courts just toss the thief in jail. He loses his ability to work, and the victim never gets compensated. I think God had a lot of wisdom in this law. Verse 5, if a man causes a field or a vineyard to be grazed and lets loose his animal and it feeds in another man's field, I mean, eats up all his green grass, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. If fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed, he who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. If a man delivers to his neighbor money or articles to keep, and it is stolen out of the man's house, if the thief is found, he shall pay double. And notice, too, the amount of damage is specified. It's just not left up to the whim of a judge or a jury. If the thief is not found, then the master of the house shall be brought to the judges to see whether he has put his hand into his neighbor's goods. In other words, if you agree to oversee your neighbor's stuff, and now their stuff turns up missing, being the caretaker, you're responsible. And it's appropriate that you be scrutinized to see if you've stolen or if you've mismanaged your neighbor's goods. I think this is the first mention of what we might call white-collar crime. Here's a manager who's gone bad. He's embezzled someone else's funds, a stockbroker that's turned into a thief. Verse 9 establishes the need for tort law. Offenses occur that are not necessarily criminal offenses, and yet justice requires a remedy, and so judges were appointed to serve in this role. He says, for any kind of trespass, whether it concerns an ox, a donkey, a sheep, or clothing, or for any kind of lost thing which another claims to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whomever the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. If the ownership of the article is in question, then the parties in the dispute both present their cases and then the judge makes a decision. Now, if a man delivers to his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep, and it dies, is hurt, or driven away, no one seeing it, then an oath of the Lord shall be between them both, that he has not put his hand into his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept that, and he shall not make it good. God's law is fair. And here it acknowledges that accidents do happen. And a person who was acting in good faith should not be held responsible for a loss that was accidental. So you're keeping your neighbor's parakeet, and your cat eats it. You're not liable. Your neighbor should have known that you had a cat, should have known they were taking a risk by letting you keep their parakeet. Verse 12. But if, in fact, it is stolen from him, he shall make restitution to the owner of it. If it is torn to pieces by a beast, then he shall bring it as evidence, and he shall not make good what was torn. You couldn't help it. You couldn't help that a mountain lion saw your neighbor's poodle in your backyard, decided to have it for breakfast. You just come clean. You present the evidence. Here's the carcass. Poor poodle. Doggone. And if a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it becomes injured or dies, the owner of it not being with it, he shall surely make it good. Now, if you borrow your neighbor's lawnmower, and while in your possession it breaks down, then it's your responsibility to have that mower repaired.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.